So I start with a quote. Say, evolution is a stochastic process of change in gene frequencies in natural populations. Since the population making up a species consists of many individuals, and since evolution extends over enormous periods of time, laws which govern the process of change are inevitably statistical. In this sense, the genetical theory of evolution, as Ronald Fisher suggests, is comparable to the theory of gases. So this quotation is by Motoo Kimura, who's a genetist, who's not a statistical physicist, in 1953. So I think the subject of my talk today is sort of warranted by the fact that some genetists have thought about this connection some time ago. So the idea is just trying to understand how the evolutionary process goes on. We know that the evolutionary process is made of a number of mechanisms which intertwine and produce also the change of living forms of the time. So the mechanisms are reproduction and like begets like, heredity sometimes. Then there is mutations and the fact that it's true that in the reproduction process there are some changes which come about, and these changes may themselves be inherited. And then there is a selection. Selection is the fact that the properties, and in particular the hereditary properties of the living forms, have an effect on their efficiency at reproducing. So out of these things, you have different sub-phenomena of evolution. One is, of course, adaptation, and the other fact, adaptation is the fact that the living forms have developed features which make their reproduction process efficient in a given environment. And then a change over the time, and these changes may due to the fact that the environment itself changes, and the environment itself is changing because the species are part of the environment and they change over time. So how do we start modeling this process? There is a way of giving a quantity to selection, a sort of a target function, which is optimized in the reproduction process. And this is called the fitness. Fitness is a very problematic concept, but it is one which is quite useful in model building. If you look at the naturalistic literature, you find a definition of fitness which can be applied in the field. You are given, to make matters simple, I will consider a case in which you have a form of life which has non-overlapping generations. A typical case would be annual plants. In this case, we have a certain geographic region, we have a certain number of individuals at, say, generation T, and then these individuals give rise to offspring and then die off. So that time t plus 1, we have some offsprings of the earlier generations. Some of the individuals die off without leaving offspring, and then in this case, it is rather simple to define what fitness is. Fitness of an individual in this situation like that is a quantity which measures the number of living offspring at the next generation of a given individual in the previous one. So we can define fitness F, say, fit is equal to the, is proportional, let's put a proportional, then we'll discuss why, to the number of offspring of an individual. Well, so far you don't go very far, for two reasons. One is that you don't, Aristotle told us that there is no science of the individual. In order to make science, you have to categorize something. So you want to sort of sample this fitness according to some categories. And the second thing is, of course, that there is no way of making statistics of these things. So one of the possibility is just to classify the individuals according to the presence or absence of a given trait, something that you can look up easily and that probably has some influence in the way they reproduct. So
Isn't this going to depend on more than one individual? I mean, it takes two to tango, as they say. And so,
right.
We've got culture, right? And
okay.
It depends on many individuals.
No, okay. The fitness is defined at this level on the single individual. If you have sexual reproduction, or say an individual can have different mates and they can make offspring with different mates. But it accounts to its own fitness. Okay, this is the way of counting it.
This definition suffers from the usual criticism of Darwinianism.
Yes. But then, is the way you organize your information that is going to give you a sort of a predictionary power to that. And the fact that, for instance, that you can associate a fitness to a trait, and then you find that there is, for instance, there is no correlation between the actual optimization process and the frequency of that particular trait. In this case, you find that the fitness of that trait just is not non-significant.
Is there self-fertilizing plants, annual plants?
Is there no sexual reproduction? Fitness, the way I define fitness so far is independent of the fact of whether there is a sexual or not sexual reproduction. Of course, if you have sexual reproduction, you have an individual which is very prized for mating, then its fitness will be high.
Perhaps another way of asking Jim's question is to say that the fitness can depend on the rest of the population, basically. So you're saying you're ignoring that effect?
No, he's defining it.
I'm defining an observable quantity at that level, and then what I will do is that this definable quantity will be used to abstract and introduce a quantity which is vaguely related to that, and which is used in model building.
But there is this criticism, at least in certain odd corners of the parameter space. You could have one very fit individual, but if all possible mates are sterile, then...
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, sure. Right. Sure. And the other thing is that I put here something proportional. So
you can be fit by this definition.
I know, that's right. But I mean, what I'm saying is, who would otherwise be fit if the rest of the population were different?
But that's why the teleological definition is more sensible.
The nice thing is that this is a quantity that you can go and measure and associate to a given trait. So you can have an idea of whether a trait which you find in a phenotype is something that is, say, likely to give rise to a larger number of offspring than other. So imagine that you have a given trait which comes into, color, eye color.
Because that's one problem. You can always include the tendency of the person to get onto an island where everyone else is sterile into the parameter that affects
I would like to stick to a naturalist definition. A naturalist definition is in a given geographic space, you look at a given population, and in this population you identify a number of traits, and then you associate a fitness to each trait according essentially to this definition. This is something you can measure, and then of course, if you have a significant result, that means that trait is an adaptive trait. That is a trait which falls under the edge of selection. If you don't get a significant result, it means that trait is indifferent and is not, at least at the level of the population you are studying, is not selected for or against. Okay. So in the naturalist definition of fitness, the fitness is associated with particular traits, usually you associate it with, say, one trait in order to have a significant statistics, is something that you can measure, and the traits are phenotypical traits. You can always In the case of phenotypical traits which are simple, then you can go a bit beyond that and say, go to the genetic structure which controls that trait. If you are able to do that, then you are welcome to do that. But in literature, usually one stops at the phenotypic level and associate this definition of fitness with phenotypes. In model building, you do all the way round. So what you say is that each individual has its own genotype, and then you assume that somehow the genotype in potentially gives some reproduction potential. So, which is, you call fitness just by laziness.
Is this a literature which makes predictions which can be falsified by experiment?
In natural, well, you can...
Like with yeast or something that evolves rapidly. Is there a dialogue between literature and the laboratory?
Yeah. Well, you can. Well, you say it's sort of. Of course, the problem is that you have to lift the information out in the field and put it in the lab. In this case, you're changing the environment, and it is not obvious that what you find in the field is the same as finding in the lab. But say this is a typical way of measuring. Fitness is when you make an experiment. For instance, if you make an experiment on, so you know, the kind of experiments that Lenski makes on very long evolution experiments on bacteria, then the way of measuring the actual fitness of a given strain is that you pull out, say, you take essentially a small sample of bacteria, you put it in an empty petri dish, and then you find how much it reproduces on a given time, and this is essentially this measure.
But there's also a different kind of experiment, which is basically observations, like I'm thinking of molecular clock hypothesis, whatever, where you have a theory that says if you look in sequences, you will observe certain properties, and then you could look and see whether or not they, you actually get those properties. That's not a laboratory experiment per se, but
I say in model building, what you define something which is called fitness, which is very, very, very vaguely related to this. In a sense, it's a measure of that, but it's a different dependence, because in that case, you assume that this quantity, whatever that is a function of the genotype. So F is F of the genotype, and you say that given a genotype, you have an a priori reproduction potential. Here I stick to asexual reproduction so that given a genotype, I have a certain number of offspring and there is no mating problem and so on and so forth. So if you assume that this is the case and if you neglect mutations, then of course it's trivial to find that evolution predicts an increase of fitness. In fact, the result that you have is that the ratio of the average value of the fitness at generation T plus 1 divided by the average value of the fitness generation T is proportional to the variance of fitness at generation T. This is very easy. And this is just a very trivial form of what is called the fundamental theorem of natural selection by Fisher in 22. But this is really it.
But when the variance is zero, then the ratio should be one, right?
This is wrong. Right.
And this is in the limit of large time or something?
No, this is identity. The hypothesis is the limit of large population, so that in fact the actual number of offspring is proportional to the fitness itself. And the other hypothesis is that you neglect the possibility of mutations. So in this case, you find that Okay, only the essentially, eventually, only the fittest individuals remains in the population. The variance goes to zero, and so you remain at the peak.
Does the second amendment always exist?
Pardon?
Does the variance always exist for real distributions?
For a given population, this is just statistics.
Or just statistics.
So it exists. You are given a population, you evaluate the variance, and that's it.
But I thought you said this was asymptotic for large populations.
No. This is within the, as long as the population is very large so that you neglect the sampling fluctuations and you neglect mutations, this is an identity.
How much is, I'm thinking if you have a fitness of a chromosome, for instance, and you consider sexual reproduction and things like that, and you say, well, given an identity of a gene on a chromosome, what's the average number of that copy of that chromosome that will be in the next generation? Does that change anything at all, or?
Well, if you assume that the fitness of different chromosomes just multiply, that is, that the reproduction power is just the product of the reproduction power of each chromosome, then you can forget about all the rest and then fix on the reproduction potential of a given chromosome. And in that case, it makes sense.
I'm thinking, though, that you could just sort of average over all of the other paired chromosome and say, given one chromosome, average over all the other pairs, what's the average number of times this chromosome will be in the next?
Okay, this is, in a sense, what Fisher did when he established the fundamental theorem in its original formulation. So you average over all distribution. There is, however, a little bit of a problem there. And that is the fact that usually you do have interactions between a different loci and between different chromosomes also. That means that the fitness is simply not just a product. Now, you are given a population, so you can average over the whole actual distribution of the population. And then you find that as the reproduction process goes on, then the distribution changes accordingly to the distribution of fitness of the actual genotypes. So you're no more sure that the fundamental theorem holds if you take into account this effect. It's easier, and the genetists have discussed for a long time, it's easy to discuss these effects when you consider a certain number of loci, say 2-3 loci at the same time, and you try to take into account the interactions of these. And this has given reason to a huge literature for how do you qualify the fundamental theorem in situations like that, when in some cases you, for instance, a typical case in which you find that there is no multiplicative fitness is simply a case in which you're looking at a single locus and you have a fitness for the homozygote of some, say you have two alleles and then you look at the fitness of a homozygote of one allele, heterozygote or homozygote of the other allele, and if they are not in a geometric ratio, then it means that there is some sort of preference either for the homozygote or for the heterozygote. So there you can have all sorts of effects. And in order to build, to model that, usually this is what you would like to do. But of course, when you try to do something like that, that means that this F is absolutely inaccessible. And it only makes sense to, say, to measure it if you assume that there is some sort of independence. In literature, it's called a lack of epistatic interaction. So that's observation of fitness, and there we have a fundamental theorem. And, okay, so this is probably, I can even write this in this way. Okay, so the Fisher made much. So you say, it will be noticed that the fundamental theorem proved above bears some remarkable resemblances to the second law of thermodynamics. Both are statistical laws, each requires the constant increase of a measurable quantity. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do is to qualify that. And one of the things, real populations are finite. And populations finite means that you're going to have sampling errors. And this is called by the effect of sampling errors on the genetic distribution is called by the genetist a genetic drift. We would like to use the word diffusion for that. And say, so you can have situations in which, for instance, just because of lack of sampling, you lose the best adapted genotype and you are left with something which is worse than. And there are many different situations and different mechanisms for that you would like to. And there is, of course, there are two points of view, extreme points of view in evolutionary theory, and the debate is going on between these different points of view. One point of view says that the essential point is adaptation, so that most of the features of natural populations are determined by adaptive mechanisms. And of course, there is an opposite point of view which says that a great deal, it's not everything, of course, but a great deal of the features are just determined by random sampling, genetic drift, and this is called the neutral theory. Of course, each of them has parts of truth in it. But let's see from a modeling point of view how we can look at the genetic drift and see how genetic drift is different from what we are accustomed to in physics and diffusion processes. So we look at the particular model, and we, in order to enhance genetic drift, we assume complete indifference with respect to reproductive potential. That's neutral or flat, as it called its flat fitness landscape. So we're given, for instance, a genome of length n, and to simplify things, let's assume that the genome is given in terms of a binary units. Doesn't change much to consider four nucleotides at each site, but it's easier to do like that. Okay, so therefore each genotype is simply given by a sequence of n pluses or minuses, one. And the reproduction is asexual. So we have a population, say, of m individuals. M is finite and is rather small, usually. Small with respect to the possible number of genotypes you have around. That's the usual case, of course. Okay, the reproduction mechanism is simply the following. You look at one individual alpha of the new generation. And then you pick up at random one individual of the old generation. Picking at random with uniform probability, that means that, as I told you, we are considering a situation which is absolutely neutral from the point of view of reproduction. So to each alpha, we go to alpha prime, which is its parent. And then we say that sigma I alpha at the generation t plus 1 is equal to sigma I alpha prime at generation t, that is the same unit genotype of its parent, times a random sign. This epsilon I is equal to plus or minus 1 with some probability. It's essentially most of the time equal to 1, except that from time to time with the probability, say, mu, which is small, epsilon I alpha t is equal to minus 1 with the probability mu, which is much less than 1. Okay, that's a mechanism. And then what you want to see is what is the distribution, what is the distribution of the genotypes at any given time as a function of this?
This is some dynamics defined on an Ising model, in effect?
Well, it's not an Ising model, but on N Ising models, because each genotype is a configuration of an Ising model, and you have M copies of them.
Yes.
And the distribution of these copies changes according to a reproduction and mutation mechanism of this kind.
But
you work at a constant population.
So everyone has one child?
No, every child has one parent. But that means that a fraction E of 1 over E of the ancient population does not have any child, and then you have a Poisson distribution of children with average 1.
So how do you get to the next generation? Did you describe how you go from
generate, this is T minus 1, this is T plus 1, and this is T. So for each new individual, I choose an old one, and then I reproduce
it.
At random.
Oh, at random.
Okay. The uniform probability. So the number of offspring of any given individual is a Poisson distribution with average 1, because I keep the population size constant. Now, what sort of thing that you would like to know? Well, one of the things it would be, for instance, know what is the average genotype doing.
Is the mechanism for death in this as well?
Well, it's an annual plant, so the older generation dies off. You can put death, you can put age structure, you can put anything inside. I mean, it just complicates the thing, but essentially it's in there.
Can I just ask you, so sigma is the space I ranges over the number of traits, is that?
Yeah, on the number of loci, okay. Yeah.
So 6 and alpha is the individual.
Alpha is the individual label.
Alpha individuals have the right trait signals plus one.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
So selection hasn't been incorporated yet?
In this model, I don't incorporate selection. So I'm going the opposite side from the fundamental theory. Fundamental theory, there is no mutation, and there is only selection. And the result is that you go to the top of the fitness, and there you stay forever. Okay.
Like each site is totally uncorrelated
to
other
sites.
Each site is totally uncorrelated to other.
Oh, you can change, say you can change it doesn't change much as long as you consider one gene unit at a time, independent on the other. You can change this mu. From mu can depend on I.
But can it depend on sigma? Can it depend on sigma?
In that case, I don't know much to do. I don't know how to solve the problem. But you can change this. Can depend on either, is an answer, no. Okay, so what is one of the things that is quite? Pardon? One of the things that you would like to know is, for instance, what happens to the average genotype? So you define the average genotype as something like that. Average sigma I is equal, of course, to 1 over n, sum of alpha, sigma I of alpha. And this is a generation T. Let's put it here. And then one of the quantities you would like to know is something like that. Sigma I of T, sigma I of T prime. So 1 over n, sum over I. What is this guy doing? This tells you something about the way in which the average genotype changes with time. And this is what it's really a measure of the drift. This drift, you just look at, it's due to the fact that there are sampling fluctuations of generation to generation. It's not the same. If we had an infinite population in this thing, infinite population means essentially a population which is much larger than the number of possible genotypes, which is 2 to the n, then of course the average would be 0 all the time and there would be no problem. So what is this guy doing? Okay, I leave it. It's really very easy to do. So you just have to write down what is the effect of mutation on this sigma. Say you fix this T prime to be some fixed time T zero, and then you look at what is the effect of fluctuation on this scalar product, and what you find is that this goes down like e to the minus 2 mu nt. where it's, and this is independent on the population size. That's the interesting part. So the correlation are lost.
I thought you said a population size is bigger than 2 to the n.
No, I say, as long as the population is much smaller than this, otherwise, essentially, the pre-factor goes to zero. And you don't care. I mean, it's still true, but the pre-factor is so small, you don't care. But this is, the dependence is independent of population size. So in fact, it's the average, if you like, the center of the distribution in genetic space wanders with the diffusion constant, which is the same for a single individual or for a large population. No, because they do interact. If they did not interact, then we would have a diffusion problem, and we would have something here divided by n. And this is not there just because of the interaction. There is a way of looking at this result, which is, I think, quite appealing. You have this population of m individuals, and you pick up two individuals at random.
And
this is the population n. So here I have labels from 1 to n. I pick up at random two individuals here and there, and then I ask, how long ago did their last common ancestor live? So what is the distribution of the time, the number of generations since their last common ancestor? Now, this is quite easy to ask. Say, let's define a quantity, p, pi, or of t, say, which is the probability that given two individuals picked at random, and going back a t generations ago, they have two different ancestors. Okay, so that's this quantity pi. Ask what is the recursion relation for this pi? Say, what is pi t plus 1? Well, in order for the two of them to be different at t plus 1 generations ago, first of all, they had to be different a generation t generations ago. And then the two parents had to be different one generation back. And so the first one you can choose with any anyway, but then you have that there is a probability 1 over m that the second parent is equal to the first one. So you have something like that. So that means that pi, and of course, starting from 0, you have that this is equal to 1, so is equal to 1 minus 1 over m to the power t, and this is e to the minus t over m. So if you go back n generations, you find, usually you find that you have only one common ancestor to the whole population. Now, look at what happens at very long time. So you have the population here is divided in a sort of number of genealogy trees that are. But if you go back n generations ago, you find a single lineage. And this single lineage is likely to be the location of the common, of most, say, the average genotype. It will be somewhere around the genotype of this guy. And this is a single lineage. And this is why the average will move with the same drift as a single individual. There is no dependence on the drift speed, on the population size. So where does the population size come in? Well, the population comes in the spreading on the variability of the population, of the genotypes in the population. So a measure of this variability is the average overlap between genomes. So you define the overlap between two genotypes. Q alpha beta is equal 1 over n sigma I, sigma I beta. And then you ask, what is the probability of this? probability distribution of this guy. If you look at any given realization, any time, and you look, say, at the frequency, as a function of Q, then what you find a distribution which is like that. There are many small peaks for large values of Q. This is equal to 1 when they are perfectly identical. And then there are a few larger peaks as Q goes to 0. Again, I'm supposing that n is a very large, n is large, m is large, but m is much smaller than 2 to the n. If you look at what do these peaks, these peaks move towards 0 with the same law as here. But all the time there are new peaks arising here. Now, what are these new peaks? These new peaks are the fact that from time to time you have a certain number, say, two individuals will have the same ancestor, so they start with Q close to 1, and then they accumulate independent mutations, and so they move away. Some, from time to time, one of these peaks, so the size of these peaks...
What's on the x-axis, the horizontal
one? On the horizontal, you don't read from there, is a Q, is the overlap. So when you go to Q close to 1, that means that the... Q is a matrix. So the what I do is that I look for all the pairs and I look at the histogram of the values of these matrix entries for all possible pairs. So it is the frequency m minus 1 over 2 different values for it because it's symmetrical. M plus 1. Yeah. No.
Diagonal
is 1. Right, so. And so what you have that these peaks, all the peaks move in the same way, but their size fluctuates. And the size fluctuates because sometimes you have one of these strains, so the lineages becomes extinct, and then other ones have a number of, is successful, so it becomes large. And then from time, so.
So is there a limiting distribution?
So you can evaluate the distribution. Distribution is, I have it somewhere. Anyway, it's very simple. It depends only on one parameter, lambda, say, which is a 4 mu, in the case, so this n is probably, is not there at the moment, for mu m. So it's a mutation rate for a single locus times the population size.
So that's the distribution.
And the distribution is, I don't remember the formula. It depends only on this parameter and just a moment that I don't remember exactly. It's a stupid equation, but I don't remember exactly the formula now.
What happens to the distribution as t goes from
infinity? Now, this is you have a static distribution. You do have an equilibrium distribution. You have to wait of the order of m generations to reach it, and then it's a renewal process. So it's
looks something like a spin glass.
In some sense, it looks like a spin glass because you do have you see at each generation you have a different actual distribution of P of Q. And if you look at what happens from generation to generations, then you have an average distribution, which is something goes, well, it's for something like that, some truncated power law or something like that. And so the average and the actual distribution are different. So there is an analogy with spin glasses in the sense that if you take the average over a given population, it's like taking a thermal average with a given realization of the disorder, and the disorder is hidden in the reproduction process. So when you look at the behavior of the system over many generations, it's like taking the average over disorder in a spin glass. And in fact, you can, this is not quite equivalent to a spin glass model, but is related to, for instance, the distribution of peak size, if you like, is related to distribution of the size of families in this genealogical tree. And this is essentially the same distribution you would have if you take a segment and you divide it at random with uniform probability, and you look at what is this distribution size of the different pieces. And this is quite obvious if you look at the mechanism. Essentially, what tells you is that if you look at the ancestral probability that two individuals have the same parent, then the probability of fusion of two lineages has nothing to do with the actual population size of the two lineages. So it is just like gluing together two pieces or breaking them apart, if you wish. So you can, you know all the distributions of that. You know all the distributions of the genealogy. But of course, this is just a purely neutral model. And if you like at the data, you find that a purely neutral model would work very nicely if the populations were much smaller than they actually are. We have this population dependence on the spreading of the genotypes in genotype space. Of the population in genotype space. And you find that, you can measure independently the mutation rate over a long a lineage, and you look at the actual spreading, and you can infer something about population size. You find population sizes which are much smaller than the actual population size. And of course, you know that there is a way out of this this problem, and that is say, well, okay, but what you have here is an effective population size. You just redefine your population size. Now, there are reasons to do that which are not, it's not just cheating. For instance, if you have a sexual reproduction, you have essentially the same result about distribution with an interesting twist. That is that if you look at this distribution of overlaps in a sexually reproducing population, what you find is something which is much more boring, and for which I actually got the award of this most boring sex picture ever. That is, this is Q average, and that's it. There is no fluctuation. So in the sexual reproduction, you have essentially no fluctuations of this overlap, similarity between the different genotypes, provided that the probability of any two individuals mating is uniform. It's what is called a panmictic population. So everybody can mate with anybody with the same probability. Then there are no fluctuations. And the reason is also, again, quite simple. If you look at the number of the parents of your of any given individual, the number of parents increases exponentially. So it's sufficient to go back a few generations, and you are sampling over and over and over again the same guys.
So what about the diffusion constant, or whatever the...
Diffusion will go the same way.
So it's the same?
It's the same, just absolutely the same. Okay, so
what is, when you say, when you fit this to data, you have to renormalize M?
Yeah, I say that you find a much smaller population.
How much?
Factor, say, it depends on whom are you looking at. Let's say a factor of 100 is...
No,
there are several reasons. One is the fact that, in fact, the actual say, static distribution is reached after m generations, where m is the population size. And this is an enormous time. So that means that essentially all species from this point of view are just beginning. So that means that you, what you are measuring at is something like the size of the founder population, which is slowly trying to increase to reach the actual population, but you are looking back in the centuries.
So
there are also a few known effects in some in sexual populations. That is the fact that the actual number of, for instance, males that have offspring is surely much smaller than the total number of males. Okay.
So back here, you gave an argument why the M drops out of this correlation time here, which is based upon the non-sexual population. But you said that picture doesn't work for sexual population because it goes the other direction, that you're sampling exponentially. You're sampling essentially.
It's about the Q fluctuations are concerned. That's only about that. Otherwise,
But the argument in terms of going back M generations and only having one founder for the entire population, that still works?
No, that wouldn't work. But in this case, probably the easiest way is just to take this definition and then work out what it does from one generation to another. Mm-hmm. And then you find that there you have essentially you have a prefactor which is corresponds to the average value of the overlap. So what you do is that you split this into the same quantity. So you look at what is this sigma I t plus 1, sigma I of t 0, and then you find that this is something like sum over alpha epsilon I alpha of t times sigma I alpha prime t sigma I of t 0. Now, this you know is the old guy. And you average over this, and you find just the exponential decrease. This n is not there. Okay.
Things change when you have overlapping generations.
They become much. Basically, they don't change, but you have to treat the thing in say. You have to renormalize everything, and you interpret the things. It makes the mathematics more complicated, but basically, nothing has changed.
When you started out with this genotype. Mm-hmm. Each site was independent.
Yeah.
There didn't seem to be any interaction.
It's still independent there.
If I was trying to model this spin mass, of course, I would introduce some.
At this level, there is. You can still consider all these sites as independent. There is no effect of the. No mixing of the. In fact, you can look at one gene at a time and have the same. There's no problem.
An argument that says why there should be spin glass like behavior in this?
Yeah, but say, as far as the spins are concerned, there is nothing special in this. It's really, they are really independent. What is the spin glass behavior is at the level of population. The population itself is a spin glass. you can do this just by looking at a single site. And this picture would not change.
But it's strange because we try to model this with some kind of Hamiltonian.
No, there is no Hamiltonian in here. There is only the reproduction process.
Right.
It's when you want to introduce fitness that you are introducing a Hamiltonian.
But then I would have to couple the sides.
Then you would have to couple the sides.
So it's strange, isn't it? It's sort of a quenched random interaction disorder.
I would. The interaction is among individuals, and the individuals are connected because of genealogy.
So you're creating interaction in time. Interaction.
Yeah. So the basic problem is that you would like to understand something about the. Say diachronic evolution of your population out of data which are. Synchronic. You are given some sort of distribution in genotype space. and you would like to understand what happens before. And it is at that level that you have some sort of a spin glass behavior. But in fact, here, this Q can be just the overlap between the values of that given site. There is no site dependence.
Isn't it true what's essentially the dynamics is in these epsilons here, right?
This is the trivial part of the dynamics. So really, the non-trivial is this one. If you look about that, what does it mean? You are given n points, and then at each generation you are given a random application of these n points into themselves, and then you iterate it. At each generation you extract one, and then you see what happens. And eventually you end up with a single point, and which is applied to different points all the time. And this is this common ancestor.
Dynamics, which have a random choice of the past depending on where you are in the circuit. It's very, right?
Yeah, it's like cosmology.
Some might say it's like history.
Okay, so this is a really completely neutral evolution. So let's go back to the selection. We have the fundamental theorem is in the absence of mutations. Let's see what happens if we take a situation like a fundamental theorem, but we consider the effects of mutation. And this is called the quasi-species model. And it's really like...
Here you discuss mutation in the absence of selection.
Right. And the trouble is that if you try to put all the three things together, then you are in trouble. Mathematically, of course, and then the only reasonable thing to.
What do you mean by in trouble?
Well, I don't have a. I do have one nice model in which everything is put together, but I will tell it later on.
I mean, there are two levels of in trouble in mathematics: inconsistent and hard.
No, it's not inconsistent, of course. Yeah, you have a model that you can put on a computer and try and solve for a reasonable population size, but that's all. I mean, that's very.
Doesn't m grow beyond 2 to the n?
No, if m grows beyond 2 to the n, then this is the quasi-species model. No, you want to check population growth because it doesn't make. This is really one of the first sentences of Darwin's paper of 1858 tells you that if you let rabbits grow unchecked, then after a while they will be much larger than the universe itself. So you want to check, put a check on population.
The human population is trying to prove it.
So there's no Malthusian growth, not even the beginnings of Malthusian exponential growth.
No, here we just fixed population size. So now I'm going to the opposite limit. Say m is much larger than 2 to the n, and I really don't care what m is. That's quasi-species equation. In fact, a quasi-species equation was sort of pretty reasonable to start with, because when Eigen in 71 introduced it, he was trying to model chemical reactions. In that case, you have a few species, and you have a great number of individuals, so that make molecular species, not...
But biological system satisfies M is much greater than...
No biological system satisfies it. Not even a non-biological system like RNA replicators. But however, this is a model which is quite instructive. And
what are the numbers for, say, bacteria, which numerically
dominate
the
word? Pardon?
How close do you say bacteria
get to? Oh, okay, say even bacteria, even if you take all bacterias, and then you are surely quite far from genome. genome space is enormous. So. But we have the same paradox as in statistical physics. Say, even in statistical physics, phase space or configuration space is enormous. Nevertheless, we use Monte Carlo to sample it with a ridiculous small number of samples. The trouble is, however, that we have a sort of hope that although the configuration space is so large, not the regions are not so much different from one another as far as we are concerned. So in the case of a biological system, this is probably not true.
There's an issue of difference between mutations and viable mutations. Mycoplasma genitalium has half a million base pairs, but you can't then, just...
Yeah, you get most of them, simply most of them. Yeah, but this should be, in some sense, built in the approach, say. At the end, we'll find that the quasi-species equations that I'm writing down, they're probably mathematically inconsistent, but, say, biologically consistent in at least one regime, because they tell you that most of the population is concentrated around a comparatively small region of sequence space. And in that case, the number of individuals having any given genotype is sufficiently large for these equations to work. This would not work for leopards or, say, endangered species, but for bacteria or viruses, sure it could work. Okay, let's see what these equations are. Now, say that we are given we define a fitness weight, W of sigma. This is a non-negative number, which is a measure of reproductive potential, and is a function of the genotype. Genotype, I usually say, again, it's a usual thing. Huh? Just to stick to some common convention. Now, assume that you have a given generation n of t, you have n of t of sigma is the number of individuals which have genotype sigma. Then the number of offspring of these individuals in next generation will be proportional to W of sigma. However, when you have an offspring of an individual with a given genotype, it's not, in general, it will not be true that its genotype is exactly equal to sigma. It can have some mutations. So you introduce a mutation matrix, Q sigma prime sigma, sigma, which is the conditional probability that in trying to reproduce an individual of a genotype sigma, you get something which has a sigma prime. And what you get is something that is proportional to nt plus 1 of sigma prime. And I forget about the constant of proportionality.
Sum over sigma.
Okay. So this makes sense only if we neglect sampling fluctuations at this level, also this level. Okay. So it only makes sense if a population is very large. And in principle, it only makes sense if a population is so large that each of these n of sigmas is very large itself, which is never the case. But we have the advantage. Now, the advantage is that this is essentially a linear iterative model, so we know what happens. And if we take a simple model for mutations, for instance, a model of mutations of the kind I have described before, in which a mutation happened independently at each locus, then this Q sigma prime sigma is something which is proportional exponential to, say, minus something lambda, beta. Exponential beta sum or I sigma I prime sigma.
Under what circumstances is this appropriate?
If the mutations are independent at each locus and they happen with equal probability, so that we have only a single parameter.
So the environment isn't changing.
The environment isn't changing. That means that these W's and these Q's do not depend on T.
So how?
Yeah?
So keep the size of the population fixed.
I forget about the population size. Because anyway, I'm in the limit in which the population is so enormous that I can. So what you like is that the the say taking into account population size only means that I have to divide this by a normalizing factor.
Yeah, okay.
It would introduce competition not only on paper. It doesn't change any of the results.
It would not. The essential is in W sigma.
Yeah, but say that if I put a normalizing factor here, that means that I reduce, after I get a potential population, a next generation, then I reduce all this population by the same factor everywhere. So this is competition on paper. I can forget about it. Okay. Now, this is basically statistical mechanics. It's a transfer matrix problem. So what we can expect is a sort of behavior in, of statistical mechanics. Yeah,
Matt. To follow up on that question, doesn't it matter if your W and Q are such that you will select some specific points?
Then yeah, this is what you want to do.
Becomes important and you have to worry about the normalization.
Well, competition will not change much about in this thing. That sort of competition, just to say, checking the total population. The only thing which tells you is that if you, it's the same as looking, instead of looking at the actual population numbers, you look at relative population numbers. Then you forget about this normalizing factor and that's it.
If the whole sigma space is equivalent, I agree, but if you choose your W and Q, so let's say two specific places in the sigma space have exploit behavior, then I'm not sure.
Look, let's write the equation in this way. I define X T of sigma as equal nt of sigma divided by the total population n. And then I have the equation xt plus 1 of sigma.
M sub t?
No, m is a fixed population. I have a population check.
So the population is
constant.
Is that built into your equation?
No. I'm redefining the thing for a new case. So I can write this. And then you find that this is equal to sum over sigma q sigma prime sigma w sigma n x t of sigma divided by sum over sigma w sigma x t of sigma. All right? This is the iteration equation for x, which is nonlinear. Okay, then I define an auxiliary variable, which is y, which satisfy the same equation as before. Sigma prime, sigma, y, t, sigma. So this is just the equation I've written here. And then I say, if I know y, then x of t is equal to y, t of sigma, say x of t of sigma, divided by sum over sigma y. So I can always reconstruct out of the linear equation. I can always reconstruct the x's. I forget about the population size. Just a linear problem.
And typical form for W would be.
Okay, there it comes. Of course, say all now it's what I think. Of course, you can take, for instance, you can take W of sigma, trivial one, in the form of pi sigma I. Okay? So that means that each genome unit is independent process. Then you forget about all these things and you're back to an equation which is only on, all the different loci undergo the same process. And in fact, this is not bad. This is what genetists had done in the 20s. And you have lots of interesting dynamics in this. You have over-dominance, under-dominance, you have whatever. Okay, so that's...
Well, you only have Q as a tensor
problem. Not with the model I used, in which the mutations are independent for each locus. I agree. Otherwise, in general, could be a problem. But otherwise, you just, this factorizes, say, with the simple mutation model, point mutation model, then this factorizes for each unit.
Actually,
but this is not very realistic.
I'm actually confused about why you discussed W and Q independently. Because by scaling W to the 1/2 and to N, you could just plug them together into a single variable.
Well, this is probably, it's true. It's I think it's basically a sort of... say there are two processes at stake. One is the reproduction process and the other is a mutation. And you usually model them by different biological mechanism. Yeah, same. So this is really the reason. But mathematically, yeah.
But even in this case here, in the section where they're uncorrelated, you would still not fulfill the Fisher's fundamental theorem anymore.
It will not.
It will not.
It will not. Sure. In fact, what you imagine that you have here, this is a transfer matrix with a non-negative entries. So you have the what's called the Perron-Frobenius theorem. It tells you that there is a dominant eigenvalue, and in fact, what you have iterating is that this y goes to the dominant eigenvector, and dominant means that you are sort of optimizing something which looks like free energy, in which both the selection factor and the mutations are correlated. So this is what you are optimizing, and you find that the quantity you're optimizing depends on the I did write it before, probably cancelled. Depends on the mutation rate, which is quite reasonable. Say you might have a situation in which there is one very narrow optimum of W, but all around you have a very, say, unfit genotypes. In this case, you might probably wish to go over to a situation in which the optimum of W is a bit smaller, but provided that the surrounding environment is fitter.
Question, when you talk about the connection between energy and free energy, I could see this sort of in a hand-wavy way in terms of talking about sequence entropy and things like that. Can it be made rigorous?
Rigorous, no, but you can sort of redefine your model in such a way as to map it exactly up to a quantum model for which it is.
So, if you take W to couple the different sites,
right.
Then you have a nice isotope. Real two-dimensional model.
Not two-dimensional, because there is no, you don't attach an interpretation to the length of the genome. It would be two-dimensional if you assume that the interactions, the epistatic interactions which determine the fitness, are local along the genome,
really,
but there is no reason to...
Assume that they
were ultra-local. No, this is ultra-local, yeah. Okay, but in this case...
If you start with the simplest thing of just nearest neighbors,
okay. Isomorph. If you have just nearest neighbor, then it is an isomodal, and
maybe
this was
solid.
Yeah. Okay. And then you have a phase transition, and then you have a phase.
What does the phase transition mean?
Well, two-dimensional isomodal is a
for this.
Well, yeah. Okay. But say okay.
What it means.
Yeah.
What it means. Okay. But that's probably the isomodal is not the best. It's not the best. So we'll try something simpler. What's simpler than the isomodal? I'll tell you, it's a really complicated.
The interactions are not crazy. I mean, there's consensus gene expression, for example, where you have a promoter sequence that finds three genes down.
Okay, but this depends on what you're actually trying to model. Imagine that you're modeling, for instance, and this was the original motivation, you're modeling RNA replicators. Now, the efficiency of an RNA to be replicated in a RNA replicase full environment will depend on the way it folds, and folding itself is a complex function of a long range. So it will be, so it is safe to assume that this W sigma is a long range interaction in genome space.
And why is it called quasi species?
Oh, okay, that's a twist of history. Say, Eigen introduced this equation. He was a chemist, and to him, species are chemical species.
Okay.
So no variability. And the result of this is that if provided you are below some sort of phase transition, your population has some sort of variability. And so this is what he called quasi-species. It's okay. I'll discuss this phase transition.
Except you're running out of time.
Oh, okay. So next time.
Why just tell us what the phase transition?
Okay. So take the phase transition is the following: that provided that the mutation rate is sufficiently small, then you find that the population is concentrated around the peak of W. But if you increase the mutation rate, then you lose contact with that, and the population spreads over. And in fact, this model it predicts you a more or less uniform distribution in genome space, which doesn't make sense.
And that's because as long as you're populating only a few genotypes,
then it's okay to use the equation.
So what do you think really happened?
No, okay, so I think this is a good, in fact, the quasi species model is a very good, it's really a bit on the level of a mean field in statistical mechanics. It's a good way of exploring what is happening and what sort of behaviors you would expect in a given situation. And in fact, it's used also for, say, modeling sort of small ecological problems and or evolution of enzymes and so on. So for exploring, but it's not a fully consistent problem model because it, okay, tells you it's good for as a first hint.
Thank you.